I think of the fact that I was only 20, and I made a very, very, very momentous decision, which was to finish the race, when all other factors, most other factors, were against me, and I felt very afraid, very embarrassed, and very marginalized.
Kia ora, everyone. That was Catherine Switzer. I'm Matt Raymond.
I'm Eugene Bingham.
And this is Dirt Church Radio, interesting conversations with interesting runners. Did you know that July 20th, 2019 is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 so-called moon landing? And it's also the one-year anniversary of Dirt Church Radio, and we will be celebrating that at Hallertau Brewery on Coastal Revered Highway in Auckland. We're going to do a trail run first, and then we're going to do a live show. We'll have lots of guests. We will have spot prizes. We will have beverages and a good old time. And unlike the so-called moon landing, you can be guaranteed that this will be real. I'm by myself. It's Matt here. Eugene is in the US of A on a vision quest. So it's just me doing the ads for the next couple of weeks. Lucky you. So Grant Guys from Ultra Spire is demanding that we sell some waist belts with the 600 lumen light in them. So what you need to do is buy one, because he's going to make us keep advertising them until they're all sold out. But you can get 10% off one of these 600 lumen waist bangers if you use the code DCR4LIFE. That's DCR4LIFE, spelt traditionally, at ultraspire.co.nz. And in all seriousness, these are a really nice little bit of kit. They're bright, they're useful, they've got storage in the back. It's like party up front, storage in the back, you know, it's like any sort of reasonably priced Auckland home and income. But ultraspire.co.nz for a great deal off Ultraspire 600 lumen waist light. Further Faster in Christchurch. We are so pleased as punch to be supported by Further Faster in Christchurch. This is an old school community hub of an outdoors store. They're dog positive, they're kayak adjacent. They've got all the best gear from Montane, Innovate, another brand we won't speak of, and some other really wonderful Mountain King poles, all sorts of stuff. They've got food, they've got Rocky, they've got Joe, they've got Dan, and they've got a team of dedicated, fun-loving outdoors sales people who are always up for a chat, probably on a Friday, always up for a beer, and always up to get out and get amongst it. We love being associated with them, and this is just us saying, hey, look, go check them out, www.furtherfaster.co.nz. Salivate over the gears, and if you're down in Christchurch, the championship city, go check them out. Have a look on the Google Maps or wherever and tell them that we sent you. And yeah, thanks for the Faster for your continued support.
Dirt Church Radio.
Catherine Switzer.
Episode 45.
I can't believe that we spoke to Catherine Switzer. It is incredible, and it feels epical, and it feels a little bit unreal. And I'm kind of talking faster than I usually do, which is quite fast, but I, in my wildest dreams, when we started this, I didn't think we'd be speaking to Catherine Switzer, but there
she's
you go.
The woman, the legend, KV Switzer, so who famously entered the 1967 Boston Marathon as the first woman to officially enter the race, even though the officials didn't know that she was a woman who was entering the race,
because
even though she hadn't been duplicitous about it. She just signed her name KV Switzer, like she always did, and wore a tracksuit at the start because it was cold, and so nobody saw that there was a woman in the race until quite a distance in.
And then Jock Semple got...
The race organiser.
Apoplectic with rage.
He did.
And ran onto the course and attempted to... he physically assaulted her, attempted to scrag her off the course to prevent her from finishing, and got served by Catherine's boyfriend at the time.
Yep.
And
bounced him out. So that was that was what sort of propelled her to fame. But since... what I really admire about her is that it didn't end there.
Absolutely not.
You know, she became journalist and broadcaster. She got the Avon World Marathon Series started, which was the first sort of really serious women-only long-distance running going.
Mm-hmm.
Broke barriers, was instrumental in getting the women's marathon into the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. She won the New York Marathon.
She won the New York Marathon, yeah. Ran a incredible time at Boston some years later. And now is the
matron,
head honcho. Yeah.
Of 261 Fearless, which is an organization which advocates for and promotes women's running.
Mm. 261 because of that was the number on her race bib and in Boston 67.
Yeah, she'll tell you all about that as this wonderful, epical is the word I use, and quite overwhelming at times for me, actually.
Yeah. And a great thinker.
Yeah.
Great thinker about what running means and what it can do and how it fits within the culture. So we are delighted to bring you that conversation.
Absolutely.
Good feedback from the Corey Waltering.
Yeah, it was so good to talk to Corey. And it's, you know, like it's really lovely to, when we finished, we were speaking about it and how he's not just starting, but this is, you know, he's with the North Face now and things are really sort of kicking off. He talked about sort of learning how to manage the other stuff adjacent to running the races and how that can impact, and we're super stoked. And he stuck it in the ground there. He's like, I want to win Leadville.
Yeah,
so I'm
got it out there.
Team Corey.
It's probably too late. I was looking at his blog, and he did a Q&A style for his Western States.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Taking questions from people, one of which was, where do you get your speedos from?
Yeah.
Which, you know, maybe we should have asked him that.
Well, I'm glad we didn't, actually. Mm. You know, you know, he runs in the shortest of shorts.
Yeah. And he sort of obliquely referenced it in our conversation. We talked about having to wear pants at UTMF.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But
he's, you know, he's going great guns. And as we said last week, Team Corey. How you been, bro?
I have had more Ventolin than Gallen Rupp currently.
How's your thyroid? Anyway.
It's pretty, it's acting up.
Right, I've been a bit sick as well.
Yeah.
Probably here, which has interrupted my training. You know, every winter there's going to be a week or two when you just have to go, you know what, I just have to sit this one out.
Yep, and you've got a little bit of, you know, you're going abroad in a little while, so you need to take care of yourself.
Yeah, sleep.
Yep. Sleep and rest.
Mm. Hey, you wanted to talk about our friend of the show.
Yeah, so what we wanted to talk about, and this kind of hankers back to last week's podcast when we talked about those two gentlemen who are running 231 times around a building for multiple sclerosis. We have a friend, Brooke Van Reenen. Now, we've mentioned him on the show before. He was, you know, he's not shy in coming forward, old Brooke. He lives in Wanaka, and he has a goal to run the Te Araroa Trail, which is, for those of you who don't know, the trail that runs from the top of New Zealand, Aotearoa, to the bottom, so Cape Reinga to the Bluff. And he's doing it to raise $5,000, which is a very modest total, for the Mental Health Foundation. And Brooke's been very open about, you know, he didn't have such a good time at school and things kind of got on top of him with that. And so he's just looking for a way to give something back. And also what he's written in and said that, you know, once he hits that target of $5,000, he's also going to raise money for the Te Araroa Trust, and the money will go back into maintaining the trail. So what he wants to do is he wants to live it, but he wants other people to experience it as well. Now, what we're going to do, because we are, you know, we're Brooke positive, we're going to be featuring regular kind of updates with Brooke, sort of like a where he is in the country and what he's doing and checking in with him regularly. So he starts on the 24th of August. We'll bang the link up on our show notes page, which you can find on our website, about the Mental Health Foundation, the page that he's doing, you know, and he's taking this really, really seriously. He's got a coach, Further Faster, the gorgeous Further Faster in there, helping him out with shoes, etc. And he's going to do the Mount Difficulty Ascent in Cromwell this weekend. It's his last kind of big hit out. Well, next weekend it's his last big hit out before the event. And it's one that he's tried to do three times and has yet to complete. So,
yeah. I mean, he's been, it's had a long runway.
He's had a long runway.
He's had a long runway. Good on him. He's been open about it. He's been talking about this goal that he's wanted to achieve. He's switched directions, I see. He's going to start from Cape Reinga and go southbound.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm worried because I think once he gets to Auckland, he just won't want to leave because it's so nice here.
Wow.
Shots fired.
Yeah, boom, boom. All right, so good luck, yeah. Brooke, and you can check out more of what he's up to in our show notes. Hey, just on talking about epic adventures.
Yes.
Wellington runner Harry Cunningham.
Yeah.
He ran an ultramarathon across the Namibian desert. Nambian desert.
Yeah.
The Four Deserts Namib race.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. 259 kilometres.
Gosh.
Did it in 47 hours.
Oh, my Lord.
Bunch of 40K days and an 80K day. Yeah, and he did it to raise money for Heart Kids Wellington. But what also intrigued me was that he'd done the Mongol Rally last year, which was a 2.5 month adventure across 25 countries.
Wow.
And next he's off to Atacama Crossing in Chile.
Wow, Razor Hab did that. He was one of the, for a Canadian charity, he went and ran the Atacama Desert. It's the driest place on earth.
Is it?
Yeah.
Really?
The single driest place on earth.
Drier than my mouth right now.
That's right.
So good on you, Harry. And it sounds like we should get him on the show to talk about some of these adventures.
Sounds good.
I love hearing about people's adventures.
Absolutely.
You know? And you know, just preface that by saying, what's the other one? Anyway, that he, you know, people are doing these massive adventures, but also like hearing about little adventures.
Absolutely.
I was just talking to someone who had a weekend adventure in the Coromandel around the Pinnacles, and sounded cool, you know, a little bit of getting lost, a little bit of not badly, you know, just wandering around and exploring the great outdoors.
We can adventure from our front door.
We can.
Right. All right, stuff you should know.
Stuff you should know. Stuff you should know.
It always feels so relevant or validating that we've got a jingle.
I know, it makes us feel a little bit grown up.
It does.
Andrew is sort of trying to force us into adulthood.
Two dudes at a kitchen table. So, literally. Have you seen that Anna Frost has a new movie out?
Why, Matthew, I have.
Yeah, she's back in the US of A now.
Did I call you Matt? I'm sorry about
that. Yeah, no, you can call me Matthew. It is my Christian name.
Right.
And has launched a movie called Frosty, From Racing to Motherhood. At the moment, it just looks like it's just doing the festival scene, but hopefully it's available online soon.
Mm. So they put out a trailer a couple of months ago, which Meryl did, which her sponsors, and it looked amazing, so we can't wait to see it. I really enjoyed her movie with Solomon a couple of years ago, Paradise Lost, where she went back to Papua New Guinea. It was beautifully shot, and what I love about her is that she's so open about sharing her journey and her story, the ups and downs. She's such an inspiration, and that word can get thrown around a little bit.
Absolutely.
But she is so good at being open, and we found that when we chatted to her in episode 25, didn't
100%.
We? You know, it's not all rose-tinted glasses and,
no,
you know, good times. She's happy to talk about those things. And so now she's in this latest part of her life, motherhood.
Yep.
It's going to be really good to see her talking about that as well and the journey that it took to get there. And it kind of got me thinking that running and storytelling are entwined.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's 100% true, and I concur with that notion that Anna Frost has always brought that degree of realness, of grit, of emotion, of authenticity to what can, you know, like, I love the Salem movies, don't get me wrong, they can be a bit like anodyne and a bit like, you know, they're very slick, but that one of her in Dunedin and she breaks down crying on her bed. That was full on.
It was full on. And our guest this week, Catherine, she's a great example of entwining stories with, you know, using the story of hers and other women's running to tell a broader story about the need for cultural change and revolution. She's been at the forefront of that. And we all know that running can be a force for good in so many ways. And, you know, we need to be that force.
It is the only thing, you know, you talk about peaceful mass participation and direct action. There is no greater force at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Across cultures and across countries. So, you know, be that force. And, you know, whether it's telling stories or through encouraging others to get out there and do good stuff and come running.
Get amongst it.
Get amongst it. Right. Greatest run ever.
Greatest run ever. So this is the part of the show where we ask you to write in. I'll just take my keys off my belt and tell us about your greatest run ever. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a race or a mountain summit. It might just be a run around the block, something that really resonated with you for some reason. Send it in to us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com or via our social media.
Can I just say,
Eugene?
People Well, you always say that, and you need to, because yes, the barrel's getting...
We looked in the... We keep them in a barrel.
We do. Literally, it's in a barrel.
The courier brings us the files every Wednesday, and we put them in a barrel, and...
But we need more.
Yeah, we
need
do.
More. So send them in. I know, and this is the thing. Whenever we bump into people, they always say, oh, I've been meaning to send you my greatest run ever. Do it. Yeah. Do it now. Well, maybe finish listening to the podcast first because it'll inspire you, but then do it. Right, this week. This one's a bit long, but it's a doozy. And many of us will relate to it. Right, Adam Carlson, go.
All right. Greatest run ever, getting back. 2 years ago, I found an injury 4 years after becoming an ultra runner. So is that 6 years ago? Anyway. About 6 years ago, a broken scaphoid bone got me into this mess, into this community and into this whānau. I had been in a cast for 6 weeks and still had another month or so to go. My wife was sick of my moping, my disgust at life and not being able to get onto my mountain bike or do anything useful with the climbing shoes. I bought running shoes, the cheapest Nikes I could buy. They were blue and they looked fast. They started me down the rooty, rocky road to being a runner. I did a marathon and a half, oddly in that order. A marathon
and then a half marathon,
oddly in that order. Then the Great Naseby Water Race. Alien and Jamie opened the door to the ultra cupboard. They threw it wide open over there with open arms and hearts. The cupboard is hidden in Naseby. It's a sleepy town on a wet gully road, and the cupboard door lies amongst tents, campervans and gazebos frozen into the tailings of long gone gold miners. It is our own little secret world. It's not Leadville, it's not Silverton, but it's mining and it's ultra running.
So I'll bust in here, and you can probably pick up from what Adam is saying that he was basically hooked on running, trail running, and he was into it, running all sorts of races, loving it, when he started to get a pain in his ankle that wouldn't go away. And it was a contusion in the Tala Dome.
Yep.
What, Nurse Matt, what's that?
It's a bit in your ankle.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Right. So eventually, by trusting the process and working his way back slowly, he lined up for his first ultra after 2 years of recovery.
Which was the Northburn 50K, and it was a good place to return to ultra marathon running. It wasn't going to be easy. It was definitely going to test my ankle and my recovery, and I'll say, look, I'm sorry, I don't do ankles, I do feelings. Start lines in the dark are the best. The visual stimulus is lower, it heightens the other senses. I love the sound of hundreds of feet on dirt padding their way out into the unknown. Stealing Ben's words, we are all collectively going out on the hunt for the antelope. I'd love to say I could smell the fear of some and the anticipation of others. I couldn't. In central Otago, you can only smell the time. Remember the time at Northburn? Remember that time? Spelled T-H-Y-M-E.
Yeah, it's probably one that works in writing and not so much.
Not so much on radio, right? Yeah. Anyway, the home loop comes and goes faster than you'd expect. The sense of anticipation for getting stuck into it is there, though. So let's get into that hill. Watching as the sun rises, as we rise into the cloud. The view isn't going to show its face this morning. The cloud wraps us up warm, though. The dew is heavy, but the cloud is warm. Uphill kilometres early in a race seem to move quickly. I'm always too busy thinking. And I'll be honest, I don't know what I was thinking about, but at that time, it was important. Was it my pace, my feeling? I don't know. I do know it's the first race I haven't done full-body check-ins. Maybe that's a good thing. Feeling my way through rather than trying to quantify it. Off trail, running through soft moss, down a creek, up creek, across the moon, then down, the lake appears through the cloud. The time is looking good. The last 10-kilometre loop of deception is deceiving in so many ways, not least because it isn't 10 kilometres, it's more like 12 or 13, Terry.
And like that Terry needs to be said, Terry.
No, well, I actually go like, Terry, that's excellent. Still, that time is looking good. 7 hours was the target, and I'm into the last 4 kilometres. It was 6 kilometres, Terry. I agree with Terry, and it's not yet the 6 hour mark. The last few kilometres of any race are always hard. They should be. You should be leaving everything out there, and if you haven't, now is the time. I can hear my wife and kids calling me in. There are tears welling up in my eyes. The grimace is a smile. The pain is good. I cry my way across the finish line in 6 hours 15 minutes. I cross the line, and the pain is so good. The satisfaction is so high. Terry gets me a beer. I sit on the... All's forgiven, I would suppose. Sit on the grass, Grandstand Hill beside the finish line and watch the other finishers come in. It's done. The recovery is over. I can see the 100-kilometre mark and the milers run into the tent and out the other side. It's hot now and hard work out there. Was it the best run ever? It was mine so far. It paves my way to the next best, greatest run ever.
Fantastic.
Fantastic, all right. Yeah. Goodness me.
Yeah, beautiful riding there. And brilliant to have... come back from that ankle injury.
Yeah.
And, you know, applied himself. And you can read on the site where we post all our greatest runs ever, the full version of that. And he goes through his recovery and what it took to get back.
Yeah.
And the application, I suppose, that was required to be able to get to that start line. And
we don't abridge on the website.
No, we don't.
So on to our guest.
Mm. I feel like we should be standing.
Yeah, I sort of do too. So let's just crack on with this introduction. In 1967, Catherine Switzer became the first woman to officially register and complete the Boston Marathon, which infuriated one of the race directors so much that he ran onto the road and physically assaulted her, tried to drag her out of the own race. Yeah, so she completed the race despite his best efforts and went on to run a bunch more marathons, winning the New York City Marathon in 1974 and helping to secure the women's marathon as an Olympic Games event. She wrote Marathon Woman, which is a thoroughly good read, and is also Running and Walking for Women Over 40. She was the co-author of 26.2 Marathon Stories, which is, you know, another great read, as Eugene keeps telling me. She's an Emmy Award-winning television commentator and is the founder of 261 Fearless, a non-profit that empowers and connects women through running. She lives between New York and New Zealand with her husband, Roger Robinson, who was a previous guest on the show. And we couldn't be more privileged and honoured to have KV Switzer talking with us.
Very, very proud.
We just need to let you know that Catherine does talk about the event and the first Boston Marathon, and she does talk about it as an assault, which it clearly was. We understand that this can be triggering for some people who might have a history of trauma, and just be careful. Look after yourselves with it. Ditchitch Radio.
Right, kia ora, and welcome to the show, the one and only Catherine Switzer, KV Switzer, all the way from New York. Welcome.
Thank you, guys. Wonderful to be with you both.
Thank you. We've been so excited about having this conversation. We've had a few emails back and forth, but, you know, you've been busy with Boston Marathon and all your other events. And another thing that keeps you extremely busy these days, from what we see on social media and so on, is 261 Fearless. Can you tell us a bit about what that is and what's happening with it?
You know, I'll tell you, this is the darndest thing. This foundation has a life of its own. It began with a life of its own. And let me tell people what it's all about. I think everybody remembers the story of me running the Boston Marathon in 1967, being the first woman to officially sign up for the race and being attacked in the race then itself by the race director, who was so furious that there was a woman wearing numbers in his race that he ran out on the course and attacked me and tried to pull my bib numbers off and throw me out of the competition. And everybody knows also that my boyfriend at the time bounced him out of the race. Instead, I kept my bib numbers and finished the race. And that is an event that changed my life. It radicalized and inspired me. But the numbers he was trying to pull off of me were number 261. And that number in ensuing years, many later ensuing years, like 45 years later, became suddenly numbers meaning fearless in the face of adversity. And again, this was totally organic. Those were three numbers three digits I had simply not paid any attention to. I'd kept my bib numbers for posterity, but suddenly people were pinning bib 261 on their back, even though they had number 19,432 for the New York City Marathon or Boston or Rotorua the next day. And they were saying, this number makes me feel fearless. When they sent me pictures of their tattoos with 261, that's when I started taking this very seriously. And I suddenly realized what these people were telling me, that at one time or the other, we've all been told that we're not good enough or we're not welcome or we're the wrong race or this wrong gender or too fat or too slow or too old or whatever. And we take up running, and running transforms us, makes us feel fearless. And then we know we can do anything. And we know all of those previous notions of what people said to us was bullshit, and that we can do anything. And we decided that this was just too powerful to ignore, and we decided to create a nonprofit and to try to take the message around the world of fearlessness, particularly to women. In fact, it is a women's only organization, and I have to be unapologetic about that. It's because most of the women in the world still live in a fearful situation. And running is so easy and cheap and accessible that we can take running to them and help them take that first step to fearlessness. And so what 261 Fearless really is a charity, it is a foundation that is a series of clubs and meet runs around the world in different villages with group leaders and with a coach that helps women take that first step. But it's also an educational program and a communications program, because the funds that we raise really go to educating the coaches and the team and the group leaders to create a non-judgmental, non-competitive, safe environment for women. So this has been our challenge, is to get these clubs up and running and to get these women coached adequately and given them a very good training program so they in turn can lead the group of women. So that's what 261 Fearless is. It is, sure, it's a movement. Sure, it's women running together. But the bigger story, I think, is that it is an educational program that hopefully empowers women beyond running. With the clubs, they can learn to lead a group. And that can even be a business for them. But they also have the sense of empowerment then to go on and get a better education or get a better job or leave a bad relationship. That's what it is. And we all know really that running is more than running for all of us. It's empowering, transformational. Really in this current era of, I would say, social injustice where social media is also social meanness in many ways, of Me Too, of Time's Up, of xenophobia, terrorism. Running really stands as a beacon of equality, inclusion, non-judgmental. We don't care about your gender and your income and your slowness or your size or your age. We just want you to get out and run, and we motivate and support each other. I always say, you know, the New York City Marathon, I'm running with 50,000 people, all of whom are strangers, but they're really my best friends. Mm. So I think running really can do a lot, and that's what 26 Fearless is really all about.
What I love about, I mean, you're kind of known, obviously, around the world for that famous photo, and it was one of Time's 100 mm-hmm. most influential photos of all time, of that moment at Boston. But what I love about this organization is that you're using that single moment to create something that will live on, you know, for generations to come, and kind of becoming bigger than that, so much bigger than that, just that one moment.
You know, I think there are two things. One, we all have the ability to pick up a social injustice and make a change. We all have the ability to walk away from it. The problem is if we walk away from it, we kind of have a drop of bitterness in our life and that we can't get over. If we pick it up and try to make it right, we're taking on a big responsibility. So it's hard. But we all can do that. And we don't have to solve all the injustices in the world. We you know, one person can't. But we can try to do something in our own backyard. I always loved the line from Anne Merrill Lindbergh's amazing book, The Gift from the Sea, where she said, you know, we cannot water the entire planet if we only have a sprinkling can, but we can do our own little patch. And that's kind of what I believe. Here's the other thing, though. You know, I've done a couple of other revolutions in my life. Mm. You know, I helped lead the drive to get the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. I created a global series of women's races. I convinced the International Olympic Committee that, you know, a woman's uterus wasn't going to fall out if she ran a marathon. those kinds of things. This is the first time I've started, I guess, a revolution or another major effort that I probably will not live to see the fruition of, you know? Mm. And it's a really funny feeling. It's 72. This foundation is in its infancy. It's only 2.5 years old. We're already in 11 countries, and we have so much work to do. But I probably will not see major social change from this until I'm dead. I mean, I probably won't see it. It probably won't happen until I'm dead. I mean, there's so many things I wanted to do. In fact, the foundation itself was started when I was at a press conference in Austria for the Austrian Women's Run about 6 years ago. And I said to the women there who were elite athletes, I said, you know, what I really would love you guys to think of is when you finish your elite careers, long after this race, think about how you're going to put back into the sport. Think about how the sport has changed you and given you benefits that you never imagined. And that your mothers certainly would never have imagined, and how the sport's going to change, and what are you going to be doing to change it? And I said, for instance, what could you do to help change the situation for women in the Middle East or North Africa? And they all look kind of dumbfounded. And a woman in the back of the room, a journalist, came up to me and said, what you said about your bib number 261 is very, very powerful. And you could combine those two things and really do major change. And I said, yes, but not in my lifetime. And she said, oh, yes, in your lifetime. And I said, well, I'm talking about women who are poor. I'm talking about women who are under burqas here. And she said, you have to understand that we have something called an internet. And I said, and you have to understand these women are extremely poor. They're bound by culture, social restriction, and poverty. And she said, yes, but one woman in every 10, no matter how poor they are, is going to have an internet connection. Look at what happened with Arab Spring. And I suddenly realized, wow, I'm talking to a whole new generation here. And that woman is now the CEO of 261 Fearless. she's Edith Zushman, and she's headquartered in Austria. And she has a vision and a strategic brain, of course, that I don't have, because I'm of a generation that can't quite yet see the vastness of our technological potential like she can. So that's why I think it's important for all of us as we get older to learn as much as we can, but also to pass on to a younger generation who can make things happen.
Yeah, and that's what I love too, is that you are empowering all these women, not only you know, at that sort of senior level within the organization, but at the ground level, all these, the coaches and the people who are organizing the runs. And we, you know, we have them here in New Zealand. We have,
you do there. Yeah. And I'll tell you that the women in New Zealand with 261 are so fabulous. Yeah. They're just absolutely wonderful. And everybody listening, and those of you who are from New Zealand and Australia, I would really love you to think about a club in your own community. Just go to 261fearless.org. And there is, a button to push if you want to start a club or an organization, or just join us, just be a member. And you're going to have a global network of friends and contacts. It's really amazing.
Mm. No, you go. I was going to say, you kind of touched on this, but I've always been intrigued by, you know, that moment happened in 1967. It was, I imagine, traumatic. It was a violent thing.
It was an assault.
But you know, you didn't just leave it there. You, excuse the pun, well, you can't say that when you're about to drop a pun, but you ran with it. You know, you didn't leave it there. You did go on and make sure that, and campaign hard to get women running the marathon in the Olympics. You founded the Avon Women's Series. You did so much else. What was it about you that meant that wasn't just an inconvenient thing that happened to you, and then you moved on with your life?
Well, first of all, I think of it too now. I think of the fact that I was only 20, and I made a very, very, very momentous decision, which was to finish the race when all other factors, most other factors, were against me, and I felt very afraid, very embarrassed, and very marginalized. But you have to understand another thing. First of all, every man in the race was wonderful to me. You know, running is amazing that way. You know, that's how I said, we're all about motivating each other. We don't care about our gender or whatever. We have respect for each other and motivate each other in every race, all strangers, men, women, whatever. And that the running as a sport is unique in that way. So all of the men were very supportive of me and said, go for it. And they kind of banded around me at that moment and helped. And of course, my boyfriend decked him and my coach was totally supportive. But there was that split second of real fear and real embarrassment, because I was afraid of the guy. I mean, he was really out of control.
Yeah.
And I thought, I just wanted to cover my face and go home to my mom, because this was happening in front of the press truck and all the camera guys were grinding down on me and screaming and yelling. And then when the incident was over and my boyfriend had knocked the official away, the guys on the press bus stayed with me for a long time and were very aggressive. You know, what are you trying to prove? You know, are you a suffragette? When are you going to drop out? When are you going to drop out? You're going to drop out. When are you going to drop out? They couldn't believe I was going to finish, and they wanted me desperately to drop out. Mm. So with it was hardly reinforcing. And but I knew that suddenly all the brouhaha about what was called women's liberation in those days. And as a 20-year-old, I really wasn't paying much attention to it. I just sort of had my head down and I tried to do my own thing. And I thought if women didn't take part in sports, well, that was their fault. They didn't get it. I had no idea. Mm. And I knew, and people were always saying, women are always barging into places where they're not welcome and they can't do it anyway. And suddenly I realized, well, no wonder they can't do it anyway if they're treated like this. This is unbelievable. Mm. And I suddenly realized if I didn't finish the race, people would say, see, she's just another woman who barged into a place and couldn't do it anyway. So I knew I had to finish. And I turned to my coach and said, you know, I'm going to finish this race on my hands and my knees if I have to. And at 20, how did I have the guts to make that decision?
Yeah.
Well, not only was I determined, I knew that as embarrassed as I was, I'd be more embarrassed dropping out. Mm. I also had trained hard. I had trained 50Ks 2 weeks before. I'd done a 50K run 2 weeks before that. So I said, hey, what am I going to do? Leave it on the roadside? Hell no. And the other thing is, and I want to press this on everybody, is that I started running when I was 12 because my dad had said, you could make the field hockey team in your local high school when you get to high school if you ran a mile a day. And I thought a mile a day was huge. And he said, no, you can do it right now. It's not about going fast. It's just about doing it. And you'll get in condition. And I didn't know what that meant. I thought it was magic, right? But I started this mile a day when I was only 12, and I carried it on. So now I was 20, and I had worked my way up through 3 miles a day to 5, and now here I was running the marathon distance relatively easily. I mean, my coach passed out in practice during the 50K run. And he was
his uterus fell out.
Yeah, well, he was convinced, you know, that women have inherent potential in endurance and stamina. And you know what? We were right. Mm. We were 50 years ahead of time, but we're showing now women in ultra runs are winning outright and often bringing that Grand Traverse team home of men and women. But that's another story. But at any rate, I had a sense of empowerment from this run every day since I was 12 years old. I always felt like I had a victory under my belt every day that nobody could take away from me as long as I ran my magic mile. And here now, the idea of being unempowered was just not in my focus. I was going to finish the race, no question. So I did. I forgave the official, you know, at about a little over 30Ks. You can't run. I have this theory. You can't run 30Ks and stay mad. After that, you know, everything goes. And I got quite philosophical and said, I wonder where the other women are. And then I realized they weren't there because they had been afraid and that they needed opportunities to disprove their fear. And they didn't have those opportunities and that I had been one very lucky girl. And I felt obligated to pay back. You know, I do have this kind of pathological sense of responsibility. And I felt like I really had to pay back. And so I didn't know what it looked like, but I knew that I was going to try to become a better athlete and that I was going to try to create the opportunities for other women. And it became a career. I mean, who could have imagined that? It became a career. It was astonishing.
And I imagine that, you know, and you're right, it's a very visceral image. And it's that you know, you were being assaulted in that moment, but I imagine that the antipathy and the anger didn't stop once you crossed the finish line.
Well, I wasn't angry with him anymore.
No, I'm talking about everyone else being angry with you. I mean, if that's what he's willing to do in public as a race official, you know, I imagine that there would be a lot more people who would have, a lot more men, let's be clear, who would have been very, very angry that you dared to do this.
Oh, and it wasn't just the men. I got to tell you, the women were worse to me than the men were.
Really?
Isn't that? Yeah. I'm sorry to say that. At the time, the women were really cruel. And I never gotten driven off the road by a guy, but I gotten driven off the road plenty of times by a woman. And I remember many times I would be with my coach. We'd be running together. And I would say, why is it always a woman? And he said, that's because she's afraid of you. She regards you as a threat. And I said, Arnie, for God's sakes, all she has to do is put on her shoes and go out and run. And he said, you know that. I know that. She don't know that. That's what he always, she don't know that yet. And I said, you know, Arnie, by the time I'm 40, I'm going to have a lot of great friends. They're going to get it by the time they're 40. And actually, it happened a lot faster than that. Mm. I was angry at them, but I felt sorry for them. And it just reinforced the need for me to help change their minds. And I've got to tell you guys, one of the most amazing things over all these years is the number of women who have come up to me who are my age. And they say, look, I'm really sorry for the way I treated you. You don't know me. I wrote you a really crappy letter, or I did something. I thought you were a crazy person. And now I'm a runner, and it has changed my life. And I said, that's okay. You know, I'm kind of like the church. You know, I'll forgive you anything if you get the right religion in the end.
Do you think it was the sense of it was the fact that you'd gone and done it, and what that meant? It sort of cast that very set in stone role of a woman into it broke that mold, or it sort of cast uncertainty in their life, or what?
Yeah. I think, look, in general, guys, I think we're all, most of us are afraid of powerful people somehow. And women especially, I think, are afraid of other powerful women because they know they're not powerful and they don't know how to be powerful, and therefore they regard it as a threat. I mean, it's just, this is completely off the subject, but it is totally on the subject. There's a massive article 2 days ago in the New York Times about women's female genital mutilation, mm-hmm. and a terrible topic. But most of that mutilation is done by other women. Mm. They were done by mothers and grandmothers and aunties who want to perpetuate this myth of helplessness and non independence. And it's very hard to overcome generations and generations and thousands of years of fear and myth. There were so many myths that I had to fight. You know, the myth of the big legs, the myth of a woman turning into a man, of turning into a lesbian. Who cares right now? But anyway, all of these things were things that we had to fight. And in fact, getting the women's marathon into the Olympic Games, it was not only the international representation I had to prove. It was also the fact that many countries were still very, very frightened of women doing anything arduous, because they really did believe this myth that they would either turn into men or be men in disguise, or that they would never be able to have children, and that the sport was going to be to blame for it. Mm. So those myths had to be overcome. Fortunately, you know, I had a really good sponsor, and we did some sort of scholarship work with doctors, and the end result was that not only was the marathon not harmful to women, is that women emerge superior in endurance and stamina. So we are really looking at a very exciting future for women in sports in the future. And for many people listening, I really hope, young people, this is something that I think is going to be one of the most exciting looks of the future for sport, because and let's just look at it this way. Let's say 3,000 years of Olympic sport has been about speed, power, and strength, which is what men excel in. Women do not have that capability. You know, okay, some women are a lot stronger than other women, but we don't have the capability in general that men have. But if women have superior endurance, stamina, flexibility, and balance, we just haven't had women's sports until about 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Mm. And we're going to create those sports. Who says the Olympic Games has to look the way it looks? Why couldn't we have a 24-hour run or a six-day race? Or why couldn't we have a relay team like we do some places in New Zealand, where there are three men on the team and three women on the team, and they race for 6 days over some kind of amazing obstacle course? You know, sport doesn't have to look exactly like it looks, and it's changed already. We're appreciating what women can do in a different way, like in tennis and in soccer gymnastics, etc. And those have their different variations. I mean, there are plenty of people who like to watch women's tennis or women's, in my case, women's soccer. I prefer to watch women play soccer than men.
And, it's a really skillful, amazing game.
It is, but it's a different sport in its own
totally,
way.
Totally, absolutely.
Women's sevens rugby.
Yeah, women's sevens rugby. Exactly.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. So, but who would have imagined women's sevens rugby even 50 years ago?
Yeah. And, So
you guys are going to change it. I don't mean you two necessarily, but yes, in a way, you two, because by the proliferation of information like this to potentially thousands or even millions of people, somebody out is going to get out there and get an idea, and it's a revenue stream.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing too, and it has to be more than, I guess, it has to make sense to people both economically and, you know, and it's that thing about, I guess, and I'm a registered nurse, so I work in a very female heavy industry, you know, and that for years, you know, the income streams for men and women have been less for women, you know, and I recognize that because I work in an industry which is not paid what it's deserved,
what it's worth. And that, just picking up on the, you know, that whole ability of women to endure in ways that men can't. I mean, we've talked on the show to runners like Courtney DeWalter and Camille Heron, Katie Wright, and I was going to say, you know, who've beaten men in races. You know, came first overall, and then just the other week we had a race here in New Zealand, a last person standing event where it's just everyone lines up and goes until they can't anymore, and it was won by a Nelson doctor, Dr. Katie Wright. You know, and so
woo-hoo!
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we are seeing in front of our eyes the manifestation of exactly what you were saying way back when, and when no one would believe you.
But also what's important, and I mean not to get to, but like, yes, we saw that, and I was race directing that, so I saw that. But you know what? My daughters, Lily and Lola, saw that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So their mum, who's a very, you know, far superior marathon runner than I am, perpetuates that. And there's all that kind of – It's a movement.
Yeah,
it is. You know, when they see it, it is astonishing. We're into our second generation now of what I call "See Mommy Run," where the children are growing up, and mommy goes out in the morning or whenever she. But it's not unusual. And what she's actually showing is a pattern of good health for the family, and also that she's taking time for herself. Mm-hmm. And you guys are going to have to be a little independent now, because I'm going to go out for 20 minutes or 2 hours or whatever it is. So that is a really, really important message. This is how it's done. It's changing our society and changing the way the kids are growing up, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah, which is where, I mean, just to sort of fold back to 261 Fearless, it's got those broader goals, those broader things that it can achieve. It's not just about running. It's you know, building, changing culture, changing expectations.
Absolutely. And, you know, another thing I wanted to say about 261 Fearless is, you know, I've mentioned, well, this is a woman behind a burqa and she's in North Africa. She's just as likely to be your next door neighbor.
Mm.
100%.
I mean, that's an amazing thing for people to grasp is because you think that, you know, we're in New Zealand, we're in America, you know, we're so go ahead. But a fearful woman is a fearful woman. You don't know what's in her head, where she's come from, or what she's currently experiencing. So that hour a week where she goes out with her 261ers in a non-judgmental, non-competitive environment, and just relaxes and forgets all the crap of that week, just talks with her friends and has a community. That's really, really important, of course. And when you're out running and walking together, you know, you tell people the secrets of your soul, and it never goes further than that. And it's so, so important.
That whole, yeah, there's something about running, isn't it, that sort of just breaks down those barriers in a way that I can't think of anything else that does.
It's called autonomous intimacy. There's a term for it, and it's autonomous intimacy. You know, as I said before, it's births, deaths, and marriages.
Yeah,
isn't it really the process of running, and you're engaged in the same, you're both doing the same thing, and that barrier then falls away.
Yeah.
And what do you mean by births, deaths, and marriages? You mean
it's
the big
intimate.
Three?
It's intimate. Yeah. It's the same sort of. It's. I mean, it's on a par with other, you know, intimate things that we do in our lives.
Yeah.
Huh, and it's interesting.
It's partly too. I mean, especially we've talked about this before on the show. I think we even talked about it with Roger actually, where. Especially for men, I don't know, maybe you can talk from a woman's experience, but I find that as a man, if you're sitting opposite someone in a bar or in a cafe, you know, you don't feel as comfortable opening up. Whereas if you're running alongside someone, I don't know, it just seems easier to talk, and you get more than just, you know, how are you, mate? Yep, good, grunt, you know. That's about it. You can actually have some really deep and meaningful conversations and open up in a way that you can't in a more kind of confronting opposite each other stance.
Yes. But what I'm curious about, what is it about the motion of running or the oxygen over the brain or the endorphins that frees this?
Yeah. In other words, chemistry.
But you would think then if that were the case that every psychiatrist in the world would get out running with their partners with their patients.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Catherine, because it does tap into something that we use in I'm a mental health nurse and I work in an emergency department, and we use something called sensory modulation. And in terms of this goes back to domestic violence, and this goes back to trauma, and it goes back to everything, and there are patterns through life. So how do you comfort a baby? You swaddle
you
a baby.
You rock it.
And you rock it. So running, what it does is it's a powerhouse of calm. It stimulates your vestibular system, so your balance, the bones in your inner ear, and also your sense of proprioception is where you are in space, you know? So those two things are actually working at the same time. So when you're having – you're almost – it's hard, and it's, you know, but it's lulling as well. You know, those moments, that flow state where you're actually, you're lulled.
Mm.
And that's the science behind it. And I wonder, you know, I'm with you, Catherine, you know, like, I wonder if there's a place for, and I know it's not as easy as, hey, what if everyone got out and run? But sometimes I think, well, what if everyone got out and run? Because, you know, people would feel calmer.
Well, definitely. I mean, you know, we also know that a really a good friend of mine and very famous person, which I'm sure almost everybody has heard of, is Tegla Larupe, the first Black African to win a major marathon when she won the New York City Marathon. I mean, she's only 4'6" and weighs, you know, 80 pounds or whatever, a tiny little thing. Well, she's became really famous, and she came from a minority tribe in Kenya. So she was put down even as a third class citizen in Kenya. She was so tiny when she was born, her father nicknamed her useless. So she grew up with absolutely no reinforcement whatsoever. Now she has become world famous, and she's organizing now peace runs where she gets people on the border of Kenya and Uganda to run, and they stop rustling each other's cattle. And they stop these little tribal warfare things, because once they run together, they say, hey, we're actually all humans. And then they go dancing and things are good. So there's a lot of different wonderful ways to use running. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I do believe it was back in the 60s, Thaddeus Costarbala, the psychiatrist, said that he was getting as much success treating depression with running as he was with drugs. So I think there's an awful lot to be said for this.
Absolutely. And we are at a point in space or a point in history where perhaps we're coming back around in terms of mental health. And, it's not just looking at things apart from this deficit model, this medical model, what's wrong with you? How can we fix what's wrong with you? You are a passive participant in this, and we will fix you, rather than encouraging people to, you know, fix themselves. And I'm not saying that people don't have some massive challenges stacked up against them, but you're right. It's as simple as – it can be sometimes as simple as getting some space from a social situation, you know, from a busy household with kids and a partner that, you know, might not be so positive, hey?
Yeah, I love when I hear from mothers that kids come up and – you know, she's all cranky and she's pushing stuff around the kitchen. And they come up and they tug on her shirt and say, "Mommy, would you please go out and run?" And it does work. It is amazing. But you guys also, as journalists and writers, don't you find that running is an amazingly creative process? If I'm stuck on an opening lead or a good line, let's say for an article or a broadcast, I go out and man, bam, within 12 minutes, I get it.
Yeah.
It just, it comes to me.
Absolutely. I've solved many sort of writing problems out running. The problem I have, and maybe you've figured this one out, Catherine, is remembering it when you get home, because it always sounds so good when you're out for the run. You walk in the door and some magic happens and it vanishes from your mind.
Oh, I have a wonderful section in my book about that, especially when you're doing a long run and the idea comes early. Then what I do is couple of other ideas come too. So I say a person can only remember three things, and I start repeating them in the run like a mantra, the three things. And I come in the door and I grab any kind of piece of paper I can, and I quickly scribble it down because it's gone in a second. And if you take a shower, it is really gone.
Oh, it's gone, yeah.
And what I used to do is scribble this down on whatever I had, cocktail paper napkins, on the matchbook covers, whatever I could grab. And then finally one day I scraped all these things up from around the house and I put them in a shoebox. And then I put a slit in the top of the shoebox and paper nearby so that when I came in and I would stuff it in there, and I just called this the idea box. And I didn't pay any attention to many of the great ideas in this idea box. And one day I was writing, I had gone out to do, a sample chapter for a book I was supposed to write. This is way back in 1978 or something, 77. And I had a proposal in the back of my head that I had to get in on the following Monday. And I said, well, that's only going to take 10 minutes. And on a lark, I grabbed the idea box, which was in the bottom of a closet. And when I started to write the proposal, of course, my brain went dead. I couldn't remember anything I wanted to write. I opened the idea box. Oh my God, those ideas were fantastic. They were fantastic. And I wrote the whole proposal from them.
There you go.
and that became what was the Avon program, the global running circuit.
Wow.
And I never got the book done for the next 20 years.
Oh, wow. Endorphin-fueled ideas.
Endorphin-fueled ideas.
That fermented. And, yeah, incredible.
That's a good chapter head, endorphin-fueled ideas. I'm writing it down now.
Fantastic.
Slot it in the ideas box. And, yeah.
I really
What? I mean, you mentioned there you're broadcasting. I mean, that's the thing about you. Your running life and your running career has been so varied. You've commentated at how many races?
I can't even tell you, hundreds and hundreds. Mm. But you know what? I officially retired this year.
We heard. Roger broke the news to us.
Roger broke that.
Yeah. You know what? That's a very strange thing. First of all, yes. The reason I commentated at a lot of races is you got to understand when running was really booming and local TV and then even network TV was covering them, everything from the New York City Marathon, London Marathon, Boston, whatever, to the Olympics, they needed a commentator. And when it came time for the women's marathon, you know, I was I showed up, you know, I said, hey, I'll do that for you. I didn't really have any commentary experience, but I had a journalism background and I knew the sport. I knew the sport very, very well. And I didn't talk particularly well, but I talk better now than I did then, I think, but too long, too fast. Anyway, I did hundreds of races. But the funniest thing is, or weirdest thing is that now with every broadcast, I would say, especially in the last 5-6 years, I've become incredibly nervous before a broadcast. I can walk in front of an audience of 17,000 people, a live audience in a stadium or something, and do a commencement speech, you know, graduation address or something like that. But to do the broadcast of the Boston Marathon, something I have done every year for 41 years, you would think I would get less nervous. Mm. No, I was getting more nervous. And finally, I said, why am I doing something that is so painful to me? Mm. You know, it's time anyway. I'm 72. It is time. you know, for Shalane Flanagan and for Dina Castor and these younger women to step up and start doing the broadcasts. And so I said, hey, this is my last one. And it was great. The morning of the Boston Marathon, I slept in, had a cup of tea in bed, and got out and had a nice sleepy run in the streets of Boston before the race began. It was great.
Brilliant.
How was it for you going back to run the Boston, you know, 50 years after that you ran it the first time? That was there a, gosh, that must have been a confluence of emotions, hey?
Oh, it was. In the end, let me spoil the story by telling you that it was the best day of my life. And I say that in front of Roger, you know, that includes our wedding and all kinds of things. It was the best day of my life. It was I nervous? I was so nervous. My legs felt like cooked spaghetti at the start because there's so much pressure on me. And the pressure had begun building, you know, 18 months out. And I was training hard and I really wanted to run not particularly well. I really wanted to finish strong. That's all. I just, I wanted to be under 5 hours for God's sakes, but the interviews were piling up and then the story became not just, this is, a woman who's running it 50 years after her first one. It became, this is the first woman to ever do it.
Mm.
And I said, well, look, that's not testimony.
Yeah.
It was not testimony to my greatness. It just shows you how few women ran 50 years ago. And then people said, yeah, but you were 70. And I said, yeah, but there are plenty of people, women who are 75, 80, even 94 running marathons. Yeah, but this is the first time. So it became a big story. Also, there's a lot of pressure because the Boston Athletic Association had I requisitioned quite a number of charity bibs and saying that this was going to be a really, really great story for 261 Fearless. And the charity really is going to be there in force. And it would be a great promotion for them as well as for us. And unbeknownst to me, thinking that perhaps we would get 15 or 20 people to show up to run with these bibs, we had 125. Now, that's not a promotion, that's a business. I mean, that's how big it is, because you're talking thousands and thousands of dollars here. And anytime you have, you know, 125 women running a marathon, you've got 125,000 problems, because everybody's got a whole bunch of issues. So we, meaning the four of us who had started the foundation, were busy. We were so busy, we were comatose. We were walking zombies. And press conferences were huge and the media was huge. So when I went to the starting line, I thought, look, all I want to do is to stay on my feet, not die, and to finish this race. The most amazing thing happened. And that is, as soon as the gun went off, every mile got better and it got stronger. And I was going faster. And really, it was fantastic. It just finally, the body was releasing all that tension and that pent up nervousness. And I got totally into the flow. I stopped 13 times hugging kids. I did 8 interviews on the run. I just decided I was going to completely give myself over to enjoying it. And I still only ran 24 minutes slower than I did when I was 20 years old. So that was an amazing feeling. And there wasn't a moment when I had any doubt once I got running about how great it felt. And also the fact that, two big things along the sidelines, it was a beautiful spring day. And so there were literally close to 1 million people out cheering, and they were all holding these, not all, but hundreds of them were holding signs that said, go 261, go Catherine, go women's equality. And I was surrounded by 125 women on my team who had raised thousands of dollars, and they had trained hard to be there for that moment too. And that was so, so validating for me. But the other thing is to imagine this. Imagine being the only woman in the race wearing a bib number and having all that pressure of 1967, of having a very aggressive press, of having plenty of spectators who were really mean to me. Some were very nice, don't get me wrong, but some were very mean to me, and always kind of hoping that I would fail. And then 50 years later, having incredible validation and incredible support. And then the ultimate fantasy of which we all have. We all have. We've all won the gold medal right on a rainy night about turning that corner on Hereford Street and going down Boylston. And I saw down on the finish line waiting for me, Joanne Flaminio, who is the first woman president in 135 years of the Boston Athletic Association. I could see that she was holding my medal, and standing next to her was Roger, the great love of my life, you know. And I said, oh my God, because I didn't think he was even going to be able to come out. I thought he'd be working in the press room, you know, it wouldn't be done by that time. And there he was. And everybody wants to have your lover at the finish line, and you throw your arms around them. And so we did. And we had a big smooching kiss, which was very embarrassing for NBC TV. So, yeah, it was a perfect day. What can I tell you? It was everything I could possibly have hoped for. It was amazing.
Absolutely incredible. I mean, I don't know how you didn't just spontaneously combust.
Just explode, yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I did come across the finish line, and I'm spiritual, but I'm not particularly religious. But I did say, okay, God, that's great. Thanks. You can take me now.
Yeah.
I've done it. You can take me now. It doesn't get better than this.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I must say, I am extremely grateful for my health. There are millions of people in the world who would have loved to have had that kind of health. All of us can get sick. All of us can have an accident. And I've been very, very lucky. And I'm grateful. I'm really, really grateful for all of this. But the other thing is this, you know, I'm not obsessive about my running, but I take care of myself that way. I push myself way, way too hard. But I do run. And I think running is life-giving. And we now have an awful lot of facts about aging, which is that the more active you can stay as you age, the less chance you have of illness and depression. Certainly, you can keep your weight down, you reduce diabetes, you have an optimistic outlook. And the studies from John Fries and those guys at Stanford University show now that runners live actually average 7 years longer and have a mental attitude 14 years younger. So That's really good news. And it's a great message for all of us to take forward, just to keep out there, you know, plodding along with a kilometer or two a day, not being competitive necessarily, but just taking care of yourself that way.
There's so much power in running. And I think I think about that sense of it, and we spoke to Dean Karnazes, so he talked about it, and with Roger and yourself, soft power, you know, the diplomatic power. The power of connection with in terms of like, and it's sad that, you know, we can talk about that in our personal lives, our professional lives. I mean, I know when I run, I'm kinder to people at work because I feel better, you know, and that bleeds through. But what it can accomplish, you know, and you said, you know, standing on the running the Boston, you know, that beautiful arc, people are, you know, flags and everything like that. But just the power that it has is quite exceptional.
Yeah, I was really impressed. That's why I stopped and hugged a lot of kids. Yeah. Because a lot of little boys and girls were holding signs, "Go Catherine, go 261." And I, you know, would give them a big hug and I'd say, "You guys can do anything, just go for it, you know, keep out there." You know, just you never know, you know, what life you're going to change. And if I can help in any way, I'm really glad to do that.
Yeah.
One of the amazing things is my father had said, you know, life is to participate, not to spectate. And he said that when he was challenging me to go run this mile a day. And toward the end of his life, he said to me, he said, "I have something really important I want to tell you." And I said, what is it, Dad? And he said, "Well, you know, you'll always mention that in your speeches." And I said, "Yeah, sure, because it's really important to me." And he said, "I don't remember telling you that." And I think he was having this great sense of guilt. And I started to laugh. And I said, "You know, Dad, I think as a parent, you probably throw down how many bushel baskets of pearls of wisdom.
That's right.
And you don't know which one your kid's going to pick up. You just hope they pick something up."
it's never the speech from the mountaintop, is it, really?
I guess that's the truth.
I kind of was just reflecting on the fact that you talked about that day in Boston you know, as being, you know, the greatest day of your life and how amazing that is. For someone who's had so many amazing days, you won the goddamn New York Marathon. You were there at Los Angeles when the women's marathon got to be at the Olympics for the first time. What an amazing life!
It has been. It has been an amazing life. And so you have these things, and you think, boy, it doesn't get better than this. And then you look around and you realize often, you know, how much is left to be done. And certainly when I crossed the finish line in 2017, I said, there's still so much that has to be done. And in a way, we've only begun with 261 Fearless. But what I felt that was different is I had really passed the torch now to Edith and Juliet and these wonderful women who are now going to take that torch ahead. And also, you know, I had this 125 women. Those are only an example of other women who were more than happy and even passionate about passing it on to the next generation because they know what running had done for them. So I felt really for the first time very, very confident and calm about, okay, it's all in good hands. It's all in good hands. So that was great. But yeah, with getting the women's marathon into the Olympic Games and doing the broadcast of that race, and I came out of the stadium and I said, right, this is it. We've leveled the playing field. And then by 2 days later, I realized, you know, you haven't even touched the rest of the world. You know, you have in a way. 2.2 billion people watch that moment on television, and everybody knows that 42.2Ks is a long way to run. And here women are running it. And we had parity now in the Olympic Games with both of us, men and women, having a marathon. But the actual being able to reach women, you know, was still a long way away. Winning New York. Actually, I won it, but I was so disappointed because I had wanted to break 3 hours and the temperature was absolutely scorching. It was like 34 degrees. It was just unbelievable. But yes, when the next 6 months later in Boston in 1975, I thought I was going to win the race. I ran a 2:51, which was really good. It was third best in the U.S. at the time and sixth in the world. But I got beaten, trounced. Completely trounced by a world record by 11 minutes, the biggest margin of victory in the history of the Boston Marathon. And I was happy. Yeah. Not that she'd done that. I was happy that I had run such a personal best.
Yeah.
Because I never felt I was talented. So that was hard work really paying off. So up to that point, I would say that had been one of the happiest moments. Because I knew that if I could do that, anybody could do that, and that we were really ready now to take running out to women around the world. So all these things, yeah, I have been blessed with having an amazing life. But you know what? Amazing thing happens, and I send this out, and maybe this is the last thing we talk about, is amazing things happen when you show up. You know, if you go there, things happen. And sometimes things are terrible, like, you know, what happened in Boston in 67 or what happened in the Munich Olympics in 72, for God's sakes. That was horrible.
Yeah.
But good things also happen. And you get to see the wonder of those things by being there. And really, frankly, nothing much happens if you sit at home and sit on your hands and don't take action. So if you go out and face it and say, hey, I'm going to pick this up and take responsibility for it, or at least I'm going to show up and see what happens. Things do happen when you show up.
100%. I mean, that's the thing. We wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if we hadn't made the decision to just start doing this.
I know. Isn't it great? And look, now you're influencing millions and millions of people. Oh. Well, you know, well, you don't think millions, but actually, you know, these podcasts go around the world. I mean, the internet is extremely powerful. So
yeah. Most of our listeners are overseas. So
yeah.
Yeah. Well, all congratulations to everything you guys are doing. I mean, it's absolutely tremendous.
And to you, there's a line of a song by an artist called PJ Harvey from an album called Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea. And it's things I once thought unbelievable in my life have now taken place. And I would count for myself talking to you as that. So I guess, you know, that's how I measure my success, you know, is doing things that I didn't think were possible. So thank you, Catherine. It's been a true pleasure.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on everything you're doing, and good luck, and keep inspiring everybody.
We usually ask everyone one last question, but I think you've answered it
previously.
You might take a different course, and we ask everyone, Catherine Switzer, what is your greatest run ever? Doesn't have to have been a race that you won or something amazing. It's just one run that really sang to you. Now, I suspect that for you it might be Boston, since it's your best day ever, but in 2017. But you know, do you want to throw anything else out there as a great run that sticks in your mind?
There have been many, many great runs, but without a doubt, it was that Boston Marathon 2017. Mm. Absolutely. In 1975, when I ran a 2:51, I ran 26 miles at a pace faster than I can remember ever being able to run 1 mile. And I thought that this was miraculous, and it is, because the human body is miraculous. But, and I always said the road came to me. I didn't even run. The road came to me. And that's exactly what happened in 2017. Mm-hmm. But the road not only came to me, I mean, everybody and all those faces, those smiling faces, you know, thousands and thousands of them, you know, smiling at me and at 2:61. It was really magic.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. We look forward to actually catching up with you when you're back down here in New Zealand. And
that would be a cherry on the cake.
Yeah, yeah. We really appreciate
it. Okay, well, let's do it. Let's plan on doing that. And also be sure to send me the links when this is up and ready to go.
Oh, believe us, we will.
Get you out on social media.
Thank you, Catherine.
I feel a bit speechless after that.
I do.
And I think what I felt so overwhelmed was, is I think that there may be a large proportion of people who say, oh, well, that was, you know, 50 years ago and those attitudes don't exist and, you know, we've moved on from there and rah, rah, rah. And why is it only a women's group and why is it only this and why is it only that? And I'm here to tell you, as someone who works in an emergency department, and works in mental health and has done so for the last 20 years, that domestic violence against women, and it is mainly women who suffer domestic violence, I understand that men do as well, is very real. And it happens all the time, and it's serious.
Yeah.
And I think that highlighting it and speaking about it in a really elegant manner, in a manner which puts running in its place and uses something that's so simple as something that could be so meaningful is really important. Mm. So,
and it's not just domestic violence; it's repression of women in all sorts of spheres. And you know, you're kidding yourself if you think the battle has been won. It still carries on. And Catherine, through 2:61 Fearless, talks about how that's a fight that will carry on long after she's gone, she's left this mortal coil. Although, you know, she's so fit and healthy
and vibrant and vital. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I can't imagine that day. But you know, I all power to her. All power to 2:61 Fearless. We, you know, thoroughly endorse what they're doing, and not that it's, you know, I mean, it's not up to us to endorse anything, but, you know, we celebrate and cheer what they're doing, and we admire Catherine so much for not only what she did in 67, but what she's done again and again and again, leading revolutions, and the fact that she still does. She hasn't decided to just put her feet up. She's still fighting the good fight, and she's an amazing woman. Anyway.
That's us.
Thank you, Catherine.
Yeah, nothing more to say on that. No. So, Dirt Church Radio, you know, we are on Apple, Stitcher, FM Player, Spotify, and all the other podcast platforms. I can't even name them. There are so many,
we're
pan-global.
We are. Yeah.
But look, if you like what you've heard, give us a share, give us a like, rate us, review us.
Come and find us on social media at Dirt Church Radio. Email us, dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. I'm conscious that we've interviewed a broadcaster.
And we're staggering and stumbling all over our words. But there you go. Look. Anyway,
send us in your greatest run ever. Please, please, please.
Please. Because the barrel is empty.
We love them. And they're a great thing. So don't forget to write in with that. We'd love to hear from you or any feedback you've got.
Yeah.
Thank you to our partners.
Ultraspire, Further Faster and CLE Athletics, and to our editor, Kieran. And we've got another really great guest lined up next week. So tune in then. Thank you for listening. This has been a highlight.
Absolutely.
Ka kite.
Ka kite. Thanks, Rigby.